Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist. Join me as I seek out the small incremental changes being applied in other industries that we can learn from and that can be applied in healthcare. Can these changes bring immediate value, but also add up to the big improvements and revolution we need in healthcare? Come along with me to explore the possibilities. My innovative guests from around the globe have used small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot. And today, I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Eric Gantwerker. He is a pediatric ENT otolaryngologist and also the vice president and medical director at Level X. Eric, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
You know, you just made it really hard for me, making yourself an otolaryngologist. It's just one of those words that's really difficult to say and be perfect about it. So I'm glad I got it right this time.
Well, it's actually supposed to be otorhinolaryngologist, but we had to shorten it because people couldn't get the rhino right.
So for the benefit of the listeners, just tell us a little bit about your background. You're something of a unique individual in this space. You've blended some different history and background, both in medicine, but also in some other areas. Just tell us a little bit about yourself and how you arrived at this point in your career.
Yeah, just like everybody, you know, the journey was long and varied and not always straight. But essentially, you know, I was always interested in education. And after I finished my residency, I went on to fellowship in Boston. And an opportunity came up to actually get some advanced training in education. And so I ended up getting my master's in medical education. And my real interest was in educational technology and educational research. And so I got my master's, and the thesis project was actually working on a new platform that they were trying to develop for basically e-learning for medical students. And it was a really interesting opportunity for me. And it you know, I worked on motivational theory was part of my thesis. And out of that, I really thought that this was something really interesting that I can get involved with outside of medicine. I had done some work in the sort of simulation space because I was pre-hospital before medicine. So I was working on an ambulance. I was working in a fire department, things like that before I went to medical school. And a lot of their training is involved in simulation. And so I thought there were some other things that I could get more involved with. And once I finished my master's program, I got involved in some consulting, actually, with a couple of companies that were trying to use different educational technology solutions. And at that time, Level X was the company that one of the companies that I was going to work with. And they were trying to develop their video game technology to use initially in anesthesia and airway. And my sort of specialty interest was in airway reconstruction and airway problems in children. And so I sort of came on as an advisor. I had a lot of interest in different aspects of the technologies, and gaming was, you know, one of those interesting things that in the game space, technology is sort of part and parcel of video games. And the video game industry has very rapidly changed with the different technologies that have been available. And they've been able to leverage those technologies pretty effectively within video games. And it just fascinated me. And so the Level X opportunity really sort of was born out of me trying to get education around how to educate, which is not something very common in the medical space, is teaching the teacher type of stuff. And so that was sort of born out of really trying to get a little bit of extra training in education and educational psychology and the cognitive theory of learning, which was really some of the principles that I got out of my master's.
So I've got to ask you a direct question. You're out of medical school. You went through the whole system. What did you think of that training? And, you know, I'm not looking to sort of rip into it, but as I look back, and I'm going back 30 plus years just to sort of date me, I have the sense that not much has changed except the amount of information that we try and cram into people.
Yeah, I mean, the Flexner report came out over 100 years ago and sort of helped design the 2+2 medical school model that persists in a lot of institutions and has only recently undergone change. And the pedagogy of teaching people, of having them sit down in a seat and somebody get up and lecture them, what we call the sage on stage, is still used at a lot of institutions. And although there's been a ton of research within secondary education and K-12, that sitting in a classroom and watching somebody talk is not the best way to learn. We also know that the retention is so little when all you do is hear something. And yet we still persist with that model. And I went to a medical school where it was a 2+2. And then our residency training was, again, it's an apprenticeship. And so the apprenticeship model predates the Flexner Report. In fact, all the medical schools, basically you apprenticed under somebody and everything you knew was what they knew. But we're also coming in through an era of technology where all of the content that has ever existed in medical school exists on the internet. All the content that people can deliver as a sage on stage is searchable. And so the task for physicians is changing, because just delivering the same content that you got 30 years ago is going to be outdated the second they have to use that knowledge. The medical doubling time of information is 73 days as of 2020. That means the entire corpus of medical knowledge will double every 73 days. It is impossible to teach everybody everything, the content that exists in medical school and in medicine. You have to teach them different skills than they needed 30 years ago, because 30 years ago, if they just read the book and read a few articles, they had the corpus of information to be able to practice. That's not the case anymore.
Wait, you're saying that I was a perfectly qualified doctor 30? Oh, I'm so
you're
excited.
You're perfect. And then medicine changed.
I have to say, I think 30 years ago, some of this was still true. It may not have been as rapid, but I felt absolutely out of date. I felt like they put a funnel on my head. And by the time I was tested on all of that, all the moves, ads, and changes had been overtaken everything that I, well, not everything, but a significant proportion of it.
But even, you know, probably even go back a little bit further, 50 to 60 years, you know, the corpus of information was pretty much encased in books. And books are almost out of date the second they're printed. And so that delivery mechanism doesn't work. Physicians can't just be content deliverers. And the other aspect to your question is that a lot of the physicians and the professors that we had in medical school had no formal training in education. They had no formal, this is how you teach. Instead, they sort of just, basically took their knowledge base, deconstructed it in some fashion, and presented it to the trainees or to the students. And there's so many ways that perfectly good expert in some discipline is unable to unpackage their information. And I've seen that time and time and time again. You know, these brilliant people who may be brilliant clinicians doesn't make them a brilliant educator. And it doesn't come down to, oh, they just lack the knowledge. They have the knowledge. They aren't able to make what's tacit explicit. They aren't able to unpackage information in a way for a more novice learner. They just don't remember what it was like to be in that role. And so some of the greatest educators I've had may not have been the chairman of the department or the biggest content expert, but they had a way to explain the information that made sense. And those are the people that are, I think, the best teachers.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring that up. I think we all intuitively remember, or at least I do from my school days, you know, forget medical school, but going back further, there were teachers that you go, I just learned. And some of it, what it tended to do was to impart passion. So if those teachers happened to be in, let's say, science, in my case, they imparted this level of passion and love of a subject that became, you know, my future sort of developed, as it were. And, you know, specifically as you talk about those individuals that were brilliant clinicians, you're right. It hadn't occurred to me. I received no training about education, but ultimately, you know, I'm sure you had the same principle when you were in medical. It was see one, do one, teach one, right?
Absolutely. And that's the apprenticeship model. Yeah. But, you know, it's not possible anymore, especially also because the exposures are different. You know, we try as much as we can in medicine to maintain exposures to the same thing. But ultimately, your experience is crafted in such a way that it models the environment in which you were trained. And so if you were, for me, example, I went to a residency program that was really, really good at pediatric airway. And so we got so much pediatric airway exposure. And so that sort of tailored my expertise and my skill set. But if you go to a program that's not the case, it's just inevitable that your skill set's going to be different and your comfort level is going to be different. And so we haven't perfected that personalized learning to be able to create a common set of values. And obviously, competency-based medical education and mastery-based medical education is trying to, and all the milestones and everything are really trying to achieve sort of a level set of ability. But, you know, those things are still hard to come by and it's hard to standardize. And that's been really tough. The other interesting thing is that I think the educating the educator process has been accelerated a little bit. A lot of institutions that I've been at have started academies of teachers, where they basically have these sessions where they teach the teacher. And I've given a couple of those workshops of basically ways that you can improve your teaching. And for me, it comes down to efficiency. Everybody complains about time. Everybody complains that people aren't learning. But if you take a few very small steps as an instructor, as a teacher, very, very small, little incremental things, you can change dramatically the outcome of your trainees. And I think that's a huge, huge thing. And that's sort of when I do these workshops and I do these faculty development sessions, that's the overarching thing, is just these little small changes that you can do as an instructor can change dramatically the effect on your students.
So I mean, you bring up a great point. It's these small things. Can you give us some examples of that? I mean, obviously it's one of the areas that I really try and focus in on. And you know, it's not just the educators in medicine. Ultimately it's all of us, because Correct. We're all educators in some form or another.
Absolutely. I literally have that as my first slide in those talks, is we're all educators, right? We all talk to each other. We all try to teach each other something right. from a different domain that we're not familiar with. And so we're constantly having to call on these skills to be able to teach and parse out information. You know, one of the good examples I have is, so I use an audience response system in my talks, and I do that for a couple of reasons. Number one, I can get a lot of information about the audience. So if I put a slide up at the very beginning, and for a lot of times my first poll is to basically get them to log on to the system, but I ask, when did they graduate medical school? Or what has their exposure been to X? So if I'm giving a talk on tracheostomies, I say, okay, do you deal with them daily, weekly, monthly, never? What's a trach? You know, those kinds of things. And so that gives me a lot of information, because again, you want to play to what your audience is. And just to customize the content on the fly, you can get a lot of information from just doing that first poll. And then I use the poll throughout to be able to create conversations. I give it as a platform for me to talk about things, for the audience to talk about things, and it's always anonymous. I want it to be anonymous. And the reason why is because for you to be able to process information, you have to take it in your brain, put it in your own words, and store it in whatever storage system you have in your brain. Until you're tested to actually unpackage what's stored and deliver it, you haven't learned it. You may have the illusion that you know it, but until you have to demonstrate that knowledge, you don't know you have it. But even formulating an answer and putting in on an anonymous poll in the environment allows you to process that information. And you reach the people who aren't comfortable talking in front of the audience, because right. they feel perfectly comfortable texting it. And then all of a sudden it's out in the classroom and people will talk about it, and it's used as a jumping off point. And those people who wouldn't talk before now get validation that they were right, without having to be cold called or put on the spot. And right. so it facilitates discussion. And that's what I really use it for, because people are almost always, I don't have to, I always front load the polls, because once everybody's participated in the polls, all of a sudden they get used to talking about it. And they can actually create the discussion as time goes on. And that's my favorite part, is just, I'm an orchestrator. I'm here to facilitate learning. I'm not here to deliver it. I'm not here to deliver content. There's plenty of people that are way smarter than me in the audience. And my job is to orchestrate and pull out that information and share it amongst everybody in the classroom. And that is a totally different model from what from a lot of way physicians are taught to instruct. They're taught to stand up there with a PowerPoint and drone through the PowerPoint. But really, if you want to maximize your learning, facilitate a discussion. Be able to level set everybody, be able to correct common misconceptions, which is another thing that the audience response system can do, because it's free text. It's not multiple choice. People can put up information that may be a common misconception, and you can nip it in the bud immediately and say, you know, a lot of people think that, but this is why that's not true. And all of a sudden, all this information that you can get from the way that people are thinking, and then you can respond to it, it basically creates this collaborative environment. And I think audience response system is low-level fruit that you can grab and use, and just a small change in the way that you teach.
Fantastic. So for those of you just joining, I'm Dr. Nick, the incrementalist, and today I'm delighted to be talking to Dr. Eric Gantwerker, a pediatric ENT otolaryngologist, and also vice president and medical director of Level X, the medical gaming company. We were just talking about medical education and some of the incremental steps to really sort of improve that engagement. Before we get into the whole gaming area, which I want to explore a little bit, one of the things that I've heard recently, and I've certainly seen online people talking about, is this move by medical students to not even attend these lectures. There's now a recording system that syncs it with the slides, and to use that. So they've almost shifted completely away. Do you think there's still some capacity? I mean, is that serving a purpose to sort of just give the foundation, and then that sort of delivers into a better educational environment? Is there still some validity in these lectures?
Absolutely. I have a lot to say about that. You know, every time a student has to spend time on something, they are constantly evaluating return on investment. Time is at such a premium. And so obviously the value of their time is better spent doing something else and reviewing the recorded lectures. And I think part of that is that a lot of the lectures are rebooted. They're the same lecture that's been given for 20 years, and somebody recorded it, and now that you have to sit through it and watch it. It's not adding any value to their learning. The right. better use of their time is to be able to give them some background information and use classroom time to apply the knowledge and get the stuff that they can't Google. They realize that a lot of the information they can Google, they can get a lot of the information, Wikipedia, you know, all these different sources that they can use, because all of that content is online. So it's the onus is on the instructors to create an environment in which the return on investment is so high to actually be in the physical classroom that the students want to attend. And the ways to do that is to create discussions, to create different models of active learning in the classroom, as opposed to this passive sitting and watching lectures. There's been a lot of hype around the idea of flipped classroom, and flipped classroom is sort of that model where you do pre-work and then you apply the pre-work within the classroom setting. And so I've seen a lot of institutions, and mind you, flipped classroom is nothing new. It's been around for 80 to 90 years, but it's been re-sparked because of the ability for computer-based learning. And so basically people can do some kind of pre-work before they come to school, and computers have been a great way to bring the education into the home the night before. But a lot of students, number one, feel that that's double the work. Now I have to go home and do the work, and I have to sit in classroom. You're actually doubling the amount of work that I have to do. But really the problem that I see with some of the flipped classrooms is they record their lecture from the year before and have them watch it the night before. Then the students come to classroom and they're given the same content. You're doubling the work for no reason. There is no return on investment for the students. And what I see sometimes is also the teacher is like, well, you know, my job is to just sit up there and deliver the information. No, your job is actually to be able to give them the education that they need to take the next step in their career. And that involves trying to make the education experience as fruitful as possible. And the other thing I'll say about that is there's definitely some motivation factors to that. And there's some students who, and I'm sure we all know these students, if you sat them in a room for 4 years, gave them access to all the content that they need in medical school, they'll walk out just as smart as everybody else. And those are some of the people who want to sit at home and watch it, because that's just how they absorb information, and they can do just as well as everybody else. But then there's the students who don't learn that way, and some of those students do come to class, and then there's a guilt aspect for some students that come to class. And a lot of people ask me, is it worthwhile to record the lectures? And my shorter answer is yes, because everybody has a different way that they learn. If they choose to watch it and they think that that information is better served them watching it at home and doing questions or doing some other type of studying, then yes, it's worth it. As long as their performance is fine, I don't see anything in classroom for those people that's happening that's benefiting them, because they're constantly doing that return on investment calculation. You have to provide more value in the classroom for them to want to come.
Right. So that leads nicely into this whole gaming area, which has obviously been an area of focus. It's something that you're heavily involved in. Tell us a little bit about the sort of concepts and why this is so important not just in medical education, but just in healthcare delivery.
So yeah, I think there's a lot of things that games can, a lot of problems in medicine, healthcare, special healthcare education that games can help with. You know, one of the biggest things that people talk about when I talk in faculty development sessions, what are your struggles with teaching and learning? And part of them is the word engagement always comes up. That's always probably number one, or actually probably number two. Number one is time. So time and engagement is two of the things that fundamentally we struggle with in the healthcare provider education realm. And, you know, I think that the word games has a very common misconception. You know, everybody sort of has a different mind's eye view of what happens when you say the word game. Some people, have Candy Crush go in their mind. And then we say, oh, well, they're games for learning. And then people have Math Blaster, for whoever remembers that, which was not fun, but it was very blatant education related. And so that's sort of some of the realms of serious games where you have this educational content and you just sort of put a very loose game wrapper around it. So, but I think that does a disservice to the games industry. You know, this is a very, very large industry, and it is a deep discipline. You know, you and I were just at the Game Developer Conference. You saw all the people there, all of the companies there. Like, this is a deep discipline, and, you know, it involves artists, designers, engineers. I mean, it's this huge discipline, and just to boil it down to the word games or serious games does it a disservice. And I think one of the things that games really provide is the game psychology. So this whole idea of game psychology and flow states. So all of us know in a flow state when you were doing something and you totally lost track of time, you have no idea what happened. But that's the moments that we create that allow us to really absorb a lot of information very intensely. And games have perfected the flow state, because if you get out of the flow state, you'll stop playing the game. And so there's a lot of different game psychology, and the whole dopamine response that our CEO always talks about is these moment-to-moment things that happen within a game that create these loops of a more or less addiction. You know, this whole balance of reward and frustration, this whole idea of moment-to-moment enjoyment. I think there's a lot of things from an engagement standpoint, which I sort of hate that word because it's overused. But to create this game psychology engagement model for healthcare education and healthcare. The other thing is that games have unbelievable visuals, and so the ability to recreate very, very high fidelity images and animations and interactive animations or interactive experiences is a huge value add to healthcare. And I think from a patient education, from a physician education, from all different things, there's a lot of value in making things highly realistic. And some of the things are, immersion. Immersion is a consequence of this deep level of visualization and realism that, immerses you in the environment, again, allows you to suspend disbelief and to be able to live in this environment. And, the whole world of simulation was born out of a lot of the patient safety concerns. Like you said, see one, do one, teach one. A lot of us were taught on actual patients. And then patient safety revolution happened. And we're like, hey, we need to have a different model of how to teach. And simulation has for a long time, for last however many years, maybe 15, 20 years, maybe you can correct me, has really been born out of that patient safety and trying to create environments in which students can learn in a non-patient environment. And games can help with that. Games can allow you to be involved in these situations where you can demonstrate skill, you can learn skills, but really it has to be fun and enjoyable first, which is one of the things that we really believe in.
Fantastic. So just to close off, can you give us a sense? I mean, I don't know many people as deeply as experienced in that space, in the blending of both the education and the gaming. Where do you think this is going? What are we going to see in the next few years in terms of innovation that brings all this together?
So there's a few things. You know, there's been a lot of hype around augmented reality, virtual reality, and what we call mixed reality. And I see a lot of different companies trying to scramble to see how best to use that in medicine. I think I'm hoping that we'll get better at creating content for those platforms and be able to use them as a value add in education. And that's a big discussion that we'll have another time, is using technology for technology's sake versus using it our technology's sake, as opposed to using it as a value add to the educational content. And that's a huge discussion about some of the stuff that's being produced today. You know, again, you just slap it into VR and you hope that it's going to be engaging and enjoyable, and it's not. You know, well, VR sucks. Well, no, VR doesn't suck. What you made sucked. You're not using the platform for what it's best for. So I'm really excited about what that's going to bring to healthcare education. The other is AI, is another buzzword, artificial intelligence. So, you know, we're already seeing the ways that some of these technologies are being used at the patient's bedside. AR and VR is being used for opiate, to help with opiates and addiction and pain. That's a phenomenal implication, a phenomenal use of the technology. AI, using it as a decision assistant. So all of the things that are going to come to healthcare, are going to have to be taught to our students, how to use AI, how to create these environments where you're going to genuinely learn how to use these technologies. And I think that's on the horizon. And I'm really excited for what's coming next. And I'm glad to be a little bit part of that as we foray into it at Level X.
I'm glad to be part of it by proxy through you as well. So it's very exciting for me. It's been
we loved hanging out with you.
Yeah. So just remains for me to thank you. I'm sorry we've run out of time as usual, but Eric, great pleasure to talk to you. Very insightful. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it. This was fun.
Thanks for joining me today. Do you have any better ideas, or have you found a small incremental change that's brought about a big improvement in your world? Let's continue the conversation on our hashtag, The Incrementalist, or share with me at DrNick1 on Twitter. You can find more information about the show on our program page at healthcarenowradio.com. And tune in next time to hear my discussions with leaders and innovators from around the globe who've revolutionized their space by using small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot. I'm Dr. Nick, The Incrementalist, and I'm starting a revolution through evolution.